BBC World Service for Africa. Hello, this is Audrey Brown in London with This Week in Africa. For the next half hour, we look back at the people and events that have made news in Africa this week. Ethiopians re-elected Meles Zenawi as their prime minister. The vote went off peacefully, so why is the opposition demanding a rerun?
Our observers were not allowed in. In some areas, in fact, they were imprisoned. Why this is important is there were no independent observers sitting at each polling station.
In Togo, the veteran opposition leader Gilchrist Olympio explains why he's decided to form a coalition with the ruling party after 40 years of acrimony.
Oh, like all things in politics, matters evolve. But we do feel this is an opportunity to give a new chance to our population.
Also, heavy criticism for Gabon's President Ali Bongo for buying a house worth more than $100 million in France. And the South African opera singer chosen by Nelson Mandela to sing an anthem of hope for the opening of the World Cup has died. We start our look back at the week with Prime Minister Meles Zenawi and his ruling EPRDF winning a fourth term in office in a landslide victory in Ethiopia. But the country's main opposition groups are angry at the result. They say the elections were flawed and they want a rerun. To take stock of the situation, I spoke to our correspondent Uduak Amimo in Addis Ababa.
The majority seemed to have voted for the EPRDF. One local paper said it was a fait accompli. There was a huge victory rally here. Tens of thousands of people rallied to celebrate the ruling party's win. Internationally, though, there's been trepidation at what people see as a de facto one-party state. The Prime Minister, Meles Zenawi, says it's a dominant party state. He says his party has no apologies, no regrets, that they won legitimately as a result of their policies over the last 5 years. So while government loyalists welcome the victory, the opposition believe that the victory was not legitimate.
In fact, the opposition was very angry about it, weren't they?
Indeed, they're calling for a rerun of the elections, and part of their anger is based on the fact that the National Parliament has more than 500 seats. The opposition won just two, and actually won if you disregard the other seat, because that went to an independent who may become the country's next president because of a constitutional provision that requires the country's president to come from Parliament and to be an independent. So in reality, the opposition have just one or two seats. There's a joke going around Addis now that the opposition and sports cars have something in common, which is just two seats. But they say, of course, that the EPRDF's landslide victory was fraudulent and marred by violence. Here's how Haile Shewal of the All Ethiopia Unity Party described it.
In most areas, our observers were not allowed in. In some areas, in fact, they were imprisoned the day before the elections. Why this is important is there were no independent observers sitting at each polling station. The so-called independent, we have contested over a month ago, saying these people were not elected by the public. The Prime Minister got on television and said we will correct it, but it's never been corrected. So at a situation like that, we should have our person to sign it.
You mean the results, the counts?
Yeah. In Addis, this was done. I'm not talking about Addis now. I'm talking about outside of Addis.
You're asking for a rerun of the elections, though. Is that feasible?
Why not? All the papers are there. All the infrastructure is there. The only thing is we have to have witnesses. We have to have the stoppage of this harassment.
Okay, you were speaking there, Uduak, to one of the country's main opposition leaders, Haile Shewal. But what has Prime Minister Meles Zenawi said in response to these accusations?
Well, Prime Minister Meles Zenawi has given a decisive response to those calls for fresh elections. He said that won't happen. He says that calls for a rerun are unjustified and contrary to Ethiopia's constitution.
በከፊል መገለጽ በጀመረው የምርጫ ውጤት እንደታየው The results that have come in so far show that opposition have lost this election. I believe that they must accept the decision of our great and proud people and not become tools of external forces who have no right to be the ultimate judges of our elections. The opposition should not resort to other means.
The Ethiopian Prime Minister, Meles Zenawi, he's been quite conciliatory to the opposition. This is the first time he's ever reached out to them. He says they will be consulted on matters of national importance, even though they have just two seats in parliament.
The BBC's Udwak Amimo in Addis Ababa. Togo this week proved the old saying that there are no permanent enemies in politics when the longtime opposition leader Gilchrist Olympio decided to form a coalition with the governing party. Now, Mr. Olympio's father was elected as Togo's first president, but he was assassinated in a coup led by the current president, Faure Gnassingbé's father, more than 40 years ago. Since then, the two sides, understandably, have been bitter enemies. Our Lomé reporter, Ebo Godwin, asked Mr. Olympio why the change of heart after all these years.
Oh, like all things in politics, matters evolve. And according to myself, according to my party, according to the massively important part of my federation, we think the moment has come to enter into negotiations with the current government to find a solution out of this crisis that has lasted over 40 years. It's not an easy decision. We have to explain a lot of things to our people, to our compatriots, and even to our political enemies. But we do feel this is an opportunity to give a new chance to our population so as to find a solution, because the crisis seems to become a permanent part of our lives.
But your presidential candidate, Mr. Jean-Pierre Fabre, does not agree with you.
There are very currents of opinion in the party. Mr. Fabre represents one, not the most important. There are three or four others. I am the president of the whole party, and I try to conciliate various points of view. And my decision is that to have a consensus, taking into account everybody's opinion, we will have to enter into this government and come to a proper negotiation.
So how many ministerial positions do you have with the new government?
It's seven, and I was told last night another one was added, so we have eight ministerial positions. But more important for us is the new spirit in which you can cooperate, make sure that what is now signed as an agreement will be respected by all parties, the government as well as ourselves.
The Togolese opposition leader Gilchrist Olympio talking to the BBC's Ebo Godwin in Togo. A court in Zambia has ruled that mandatory testing for HIV is illegal and unconstitutional. The case was brought by two Air Force officers who were dismissed after tests done without their consent showed they were HIV positive. Our reporter in Lusaka, Mutuna Chanda, has more.
It was a landmark case on the individual's right to privacy. Today's ruling by Livingston High Court declaring mandatory HIV testing illegal sends a signal that no matter how grand an institution is, it has no authority to take away individual guarantees. This was after Stanley Kingaipe and Charles Chokole took the brave step of suing their former employers for testing them for HIV without their knowledge. The two sought the court's intervention over the violation of their individual rights, as well as their dismissal from the Air Force, which claimed they were medically unfit to continue serving. Though Mr. Kingaipe and Mr. Chokole have lost their bid to be reinstated into their Air Force service, the judgment that mandatory HIV testing is illegal and unconstitutional will hit harder than the $2,000 each they have been awarded in damages. The practice of compulsory or concealed HIV testing is causing rising concern in Zambia, and it may make other employers think twice before carrying out similar tests.
The BBC's Mutuna Chanda reporting from Zambia. People living with disabilities from across Nigeria held a protest rally this week in the capital, Abuja. Their objective? To highlight the neglect they feel they suffer at the hands of the government. The demonstration took the very vocal group to parliament to present their demands. The BBC's Chris Sewoko was there.
I I am here at the gate of the National Assembly of Nigeria following a group of disabled people on a protest march, but the gate has been locked and they've been denied access. Many of the people in this protest march include those who cannot walk. There are some who have sight impairment, like the president of the group, and then we have many of them who have some of their hands or legs amputated, and others who are deaf and dumb. They have all gathered together here to make known their demands to members of the Nigerian parliament. Now I speak to their leader, the national president of the Joint National Association of Persons with Disabilities, Mr. Danlami Basharu.
Well, as you can see, first and foremost, we are standing at the gate of our National Assembly, the most inaccessible National Assembly in the whole of Africa. We are here to demonstrate the fact that we have no rights as people with disabilities in this country. We are not recognized in the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. We have come to tell the politicians whom we have elected that they should now harmonize the legislation on the rights of persons with disabilities that has been standing with them for over 1 or 2 years, something we have been working upon for the past 10 years.
What does the bill say?
The bill is going to guarantee accessibility to Nigerians with disabilities. That is, physical structures, high-rise buildings, even shopping precincts and so on are going to be made accessible to people with disabilities. So there will be curbs, ramps, lifts everywhere. Most importantly, too, our deaf colleagues have been isolated for long. There's no sign language interpreter on any NTA network news, which the Honorable Minister of Communications promised us will happen by February 2009.
Now you have come to the National Assembly and you are denied access.
Well, we are going to stay here until the leadership of the National Assembly comes out to listen to us.
Now, after a long wait and the chanting of their songs, they were finally allowed into the premises of the Nigerian Parliament.
The BBC's Chris Ewoko reporting from Nigeria. You're listening to This Week in Africa on the BBC World Service with Audrey Brown. And still ahead, a piece of the continent comes to London's world-famous Trafalgar Square.
I found it was just powerful that you could just be by South Africa House and see this powerful image, and lots of questions come to mind, like how did he get the ship in the bottle?
Is it a case of like father, like son in Gabon, where the president Ali Bongo has been criticized for buying a house worth more than $100 million? His late father, Omar Bongo, who died last year, also owned several mansions in France. Mr. Bongo Sr. was repeatedly accused of wasting public money. It's a charge he strongly denied. Sophie Ikenya asked the BBC French service reporter Charles Maillard to describe Ali Bongo's new mansion.
It's a very nice house near French Assembly in a very expensive place. It's in the center of Paris, said the Canard Enchaîné. It's a French newspaper. The size of this mansion is about 48,000 square feet. The property has 14 bedrooms and include a swimming pool, a jacuzzi, 7 parking spaces, and even a tennis court.
Now, it sounds like a really huge house, but has the Gabonese government said why they bought it?
The French newspaper, Le Canard Enchaîné, said the president of Gabon, Ali Bongo, had apparently inherited the father's interest in luxury properties. And the Canard Enchaîné said, ironically, President Bongo even made with a gesture toward good governance and transparency when he bought his Paris home, but raised that the transparency has its limits. The Palace of the Seaside in Gabon did not reveal either the cost or the exact address of the mansion.
So, and what has been the reaction to this whole purchase of the mansion?
Ali's father, Omar Bongo, was investigated for embezzling public funds before his death last year, and last year either. The Transparency International Organization said Bongo, a family could have about 30 nice houses in France. And, you know, critics, not in France, but in Gabon, have persistently accused the Bongo family of running the country as their private property.
That was the BBC French service reporter Charles Maillard in Paris. Now, how happy are you with the rates you pay for a mobile call? Are you happy with your service provider, the coverage and customer service it offers? If you're not, listen to what Ghana's Customer Protection Agency, which is a small local NGO, tried to do on Thursday. They asked dissatisfied mobile phone users to turn off their phones and turn up for a demonstration. My colleague Stefan Mayu carried out a totally unscientific survey to find out if the call was heeded by ringing some numbers at random in Accra.
Hello.
Hello, good morning. My name is Stefan from the BBC in London. Can I talk to Alex, please?
Yes, speaking, Alex.
Why are you not protesting? Is it because you are happy with your mobile phone provider?
No. It's not that I'm happy with the service provider, but just that I think there should be more appropriate ways of addressing these issues than just switching off the mobile phone. Switching my mobile phone off for four hours, I don't think I'll ever live on this planet to do so. Even when I'm flying and my phones are off, I feel very, very, very uncomfortable.
Thank you very much, sir. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
The MTN number you are calling is currently switched off. Please try later.
Hello?
Hello, is this Ben?
Yes, please.
You're using your mobile. Does it mean that you're a happy mobile phone user?
It's only because I really need to use it because of my work. My boss can call me at any time to do one or two things. That's why it's still on. It's not that I would have turned it off because I'm in support of 40 afternoon. I'm not a happy customer. They are really exploiting us.
Hello?
Hello, is this Evelyn?
Yes, I'm expecting an important call. That's why I didn't keep mine off. I can afford to take part in, but I'll lose a lot of things because I'm expecting a lot of calls today.
Thank you very much indeed, Evelyn. I'm sorry I've disturbed you today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Take care. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So a few switched off phones and some left on. Our correspondent in Accra, David Amano, has been following the protest and he told Focus on Africa presenter Hassan Aruni what he saw and heard.
There seem to be less people using mobile phones while driving and looking at bus stops, because that's when people usually stop and chat. There also seem to be less, but you know, you just can't be sure. It's not scientific. You know, many people were actually unaware of this campaign. You could argue that maybe some people were being more discreet. So it's very difficult really to say whether people were using their phones less this morning.
What about the planned demonstration? Any success?
The street protest, well, that was a poor turnout, it must be said. Less than 200 people. And in a place like Ghana, where people don't really protest that much, you know, 500 would have been decent, but really under 200 wasn't very impressive. But, you know, this didn't deter the protesters and the Consumer Protection Agency. They said numbers don't matter, issues do. And referring back to those voices we just heard, you know, they still believe that many people, even if they didn't observe it, wanted to observe it, and that they've sort of thrown the issue out there and it'll grow from here. That's what they believe.
So what are the people complaining about, and how have the mobile phone companies responded to this?
Well, first of all, the protesters are demanding lower call charges, the kind of charges that they charge in the home countries of these international operators, better connectivity. The message out of coverage or switched off is the one that seems to get most Ghanaians annoyed. And to end, what they say are phony promotions, unsolicited text messages that turn consumers into gambling addicts. Also, they want number portability so that mobile phone users can really exercise choice and keep their number and choose to change providers. Well, the response from the telecom operators has been a bit varied. One major operator told the BBC that they saw absolutely no drop in their telephony traffic this morning. Interestingly, they're not presenting a united front on the accusations of cheating. One says it's unfair to put them all in the same group and points out that they don't take part in this activity, this alleged gambling activity.
The BBC's David Amano in Accra was speaking to Hassan Aruni. Now, in 1805, Britain's Lord Admiral Horatio Nelson defeated Napoleon and his French navy, along with their Spanish allies. Lord Nelson personified the British Empire, and a column of over 180 feet stands proud in the centre of Trafalgar Square in London to honour him and the battle in which he died. Now, a new monument has just been erected in his honour in the centre of Trafalgar Square. But what does this have to do with Africa? My colleague Bola Mosuro went to find out.
I'm here in the centre of London, in Trafalgar Square, with this massive fourth plinth with a beautiful bottle. But rather than a message in a bottle, we have a ship, an admiral's ship, with 30-plus sails, with African cloth, and it's by Yinka Shonibare. And according to him, his sculpture of Nelson's flagship HMS Victory considers the relationship between the birth of the British Empire, made possible in part by Nelson's victory at the Battle of Trafalgar.
It's a reflection, really, of the diversity of London. The fabrics themselves are Indonesian-influenced fabrics produced by the Dutch. You know, it's an expression, really, of this city. There is global diversity now because, actually, the world is more fluid. You know, people move around and they choose where they want to work and play now. And I think that, but for me, most importantly, as Nelson's column is here, it's important to do a work which actually reflects Nelson's legacy.
Well, I'm standing here in front of Nelson's Ship in a Bottle by Yinka Shonibare, and the sound of crashing water in the fountain behind me, but I have this beautiful young lady in front of me. Can I ask you what you think of this fourth installation on the plinth that we're standing below?
I approached the display from Charing Cross Station and I found it was just powerful that you could just be by South Africa House and see this powerful image, and lots of questions come to mind, like how did he get the ship in the bottle? And you just look at how much attention to detail that is going on in this work.
I mean, it is quite amazing, because I heard that this massive cork, or simulated cork that we see right at the end of the bottle, that the neck of the bottle is large enough for a person to crawl into.
You're just not only drawn to what it looks like, but then you've also got a chance to read, you know, the artist's vision in terms of like how he devised this project. And I found it quite powerful, because even if you don't know about what the cloths mean, the artist, he links the past to the present. So he's saying that, you know, with regards to the ship, it's historic to Britain, but also if we just dug that little bit deeper, by looking at the past, we can see how it does affect the future.
Excuse me, sir. Tell me what you think about it.
Well, it represents so much of the people here in England. It represents people of different race, people of different ethnicity. It's absolutely incredible.
This would make Great Britain proud, and also makes Nigeria, and it brings all nations together with the beautiful colours of cloth, the design, the first black artists. I'm sure Nelson would be proud of him as well, in spirit.
I was just saying to my friend that I'm quite impressed by it.
Lord Nelson, or Admiral Nelson, you know, he is a man who prided himself on all things British. And now we have what's supposed to be a representation of his ship, the HMS Victory, but with African sails.
Well, I'm slightly biased because I am African. So for that reason, I love it.
People in London's Trafalgar Square talking to the BBC's Bola Mosuro. The voice that was compared to opera greats like Enrico Caruso and Luciano Pavarotti is silent forever. The internationally renowned South African tenor Sipho Ndlebe has died, denying many, including Nelson Mandela, the chance to hear him sing at the opening of the World Cup, where he was due to perform in less than 2 weeks. The 34-year-old died of bacterial meningitis. Muhammad Ali reports from Cape Town.
Only last week, South Africa's internationally renowned tenor Sipho Ndlebe was preparing for rehearsals for the World Cup opening ceremony on the 11th of June. Unfortunately, the 34-year-old singer won't have the chance to sing his song titled Hope following his death yesterday in the Livingstone Hospital in his hometown of Port Elizabeth. He was due to perform alongside internationally acclaimed artists like R. Kelly and Shakira at the opening ceremony. Ndlebe contracted bacterial meningitis last week and was immediately admitted to hospital, where he is said to have received the best treatment available. expressing his shock and sadness, Danny Jordan, chief executive of the World Cup local organizing committee, said Nshebe was a prodigious talent who would have taken a message of hope from the tournament to the whole world. "It's a sad day for South Africa's arts and football community," Jordan said in a statement of condolence to the family. Nshebe was dubbed the new Pavarotti after the legendary Italian singer Luciano Pavarotti and had just finished recording an album containing a spoken message of hope and compassion by former President Nelson Mandela. According to his record company, Nshebe's song was already on the official World Cup album, which will be released worldwide on the 1st of June. During his formative years, Nshebe won a scholarship to the choral program at the University of Cape Town and later won another scholarship to do a postgraduate course at the Royal College of Music in London, which he completed in 2007.
The late Spio Nshebe singing Mozart Così Van Tutti, bringing to an end that report by Muhammad Ali in South Africa. And there we end our look at events this week in Africa. You can catch the very latest from the continent later today in Focus on Africa at 19 hours GMT. Until then, thanks for listening and goodbye.